Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Before you can buy a house or even a car on credit, somebody looks carefully into your finances. Before you can legally operate a beauty salon, you need special training and a state license. But if you want to buy a hospital, about the only thing you have to do is find somebody willing to sell it to you. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. With little state or federal regulation over who gets to own and manage a hospital, or even investigation into owners' financial and criminal histories, it stands to reason that on occasion, things can go horribly wrong and mismanagement can lead to closure. And as my guest will tell us, those left most vulnerable are not the unqualified owners, but local communities that have depended on those badly run hospitals. Miles Moffitt is an investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. You can find a link to his series, Bled Dry, Hospitals Fall Victim to Felons and Fraudsters Under Lax Regulation, at think.kera.org. Miles, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
You open this series with the scene of a woman driving 200 miles to get to a hospital from her home in, is it Tonopah, Nevada?
Tonopah, Nevada.
Tonopah,
correct.
Nevada. It's one of those towns that was a booming mining town in the early part of the 20th century, then sort of, you know, mining dried up. There's less than 3,000 people now. But until a few years ago, there was a functioning public hospital.
Yes, there was. And we have to qualify that by saying within a few years, because it did rapidly start deteriorating under the management of one man. And this is a man named Dr. Vincent Scotia, who about 14 years prior had been just a small businessman doctor in a suburb of Youngstown, Ohio, and suddenly shows up in the middle of the Nevada desert interested in the Tonopah Hospital and quickly buys it with virtually no vetting whatsoever.
How did it happen that a private individual could buy what had been a publicly owned hospital?
Well, the Nevada legislature had basically passed a law saying, you know, these troubled rural hospitals, there were a number of them in Nevada, you know, can be switched over to a private operator. Many of them were owned by either counties or governmental hospital districts. And in this case, the hospital was on shaky ground. It had lost a lot of money. And because of urban migration, the type of issues that affect a lot of rural communities, this hospital was starving of money. And they were desperate. A lot of communities are desperate. And in this case, Dr. Scotia showed up as a white knight saying, I can, you know, turn this hospital around and trust me, I'll do it.
And he claimed to have all kinds of experience in turning around failing health systems. Was that true?
No. He basically exploited what is a loophole or just kind of a collapse of screening by state health departments across the country. Nevada's licensing system for hospital operators requires virtually no, you know, backgrounding at all. There's an automatic criminal background check for would-be operators. In this case, I couldn't tell you with any luck that or any confidence that that happened. But he didn't have any criminal background. What he had was a very troubled business. He was deeply in debt to a major hospital outside of Youngstown. He had about $600,000 to $700,000 in long-term debt. He had a partner who had quit. He was under investigation by the Ohio State Medical Board for the overdose of one of his patients. He was just in a lot of trouble.
What's astonishing is the deal he got to take over this hospital. It was so inexpensive at the end of the day that you know, regular people might cash out their 401k and have been able to buy this hospital.
Absolutely. It was, you know, $100,000, the price of a suburban Las Vegas home, you know, lower end home. And yeah, he got in with very little money down, just a few thousand dollars. And I need to step back because in his application to the state, he had asked them not to share his financial papers with Nye County, which is the county that had run the hospital. And the state essentially rubber stamped his application approved the very day that he submitted it, got official approval from top brass about 4 days later. And he was in with $100,000 and absolutely no oversight of his application, no background check.
And there wasn't really a bidding process either. Nobody else wanted the place.
And that, you know, I think falls within this sudden latitude that the counties had. I don't know that law they passed to, you know, seek other optional owners required them to do much. But yeah, they were free to negotiate a deal. And as far as we could tell, there was nobody else putting in a bid for this hospital.
Okay, so this was, you know, this is not a large urban hospital like some people might be aware of. This was a 14-bed facility, right? Something like that?
It had many more beds back then.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
About 30 to 40.
All right, 30 to 40 beds. But he gave himself a salary that was comparable to what the CEO of Parkland was making in the same period, and more, I looked this up, than I believe the CEO of John Peter Smith makes even today.
Yes. So he was able to drain that hospital over the years of at least $8 million, and he did it in a variety of ways. One of the ways you mentioned, paid himself handsomely. But he had created this sort of cache of corporations, he and his wife, who he installed as the CFO of the hospital, and basically took all the property that he had purchased and decided to rent them back to the hospital. So you had, over a span of at least 10 years, you know, anywhere between $500,000 and $1 million being shifted to these companies for no, you know, real purpose except to enrich him and his CFO wife.
So I want to make sure that we're clear on this, because it takes kind of a criminal mastermind, it would seem like, although we'll talk about whether this was actually against the law or not, to think this up. So he says, I'm going to take over this county hospital and make it a nonprofit hospital.
Yes.
And indeed, it's filed as a nonprofit hospital. But then he creates three limited liability corporations. And then gives them ownership of what used to be hospital property. And then right. The hospital rents back equipment and land and the building from his companies at a greatly exaggerated, exorbitant rate.
Right. These are known as insider deals. And the IRS is supposed to be monitoring, you know, these types of transactions, but it's virtually impossible for them to keep up. And by their own acknowledgement, they need to do a better job of monitoring nonprofits, particularly nonprofit hospitals. But you're right. These corporations, let me first say that he has not been charged with any crime. And, you know, whether they fall within a specific embezzlement or theft statute is for, you know, prosecutors to decide. We know that he did drain the hospital of a tremendous amount of money and, you know, coined these really strange terms for the corporations that seemed to show, you know, sort of a contempt for the system, like Owie Boo Boo.
Owie Boo Boo LLC. Yeah.
Yes. And Tuna Park. I can't tell you how these names originated, but so a lot of this cloaking of the hospital's business, it's really easy to do because regulators do not pay a lot of attention to, you know, ownership transactions, the initial transaction and, expenditures made by hospitals and insider dealings.
So somebody might say, okay, well, he made some unpalatable choices in terms of the hospital's finances, but what sort of care did he provide? Because he was there on site running the emergency
mm-hmm.
department.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I would like to say that the reviews of the care were mixed, but in the dozens and dozens of interviews I did with the residents of the town, the leaders of the town, I found only a couple of people who actually praised the care that the hospital was providing or that he was providing. I need to make that clear because there are many, many excellent nurses and doctors who did work there over the decade. But, one of the reasons you know, I felt it was so important to examine these licensure or the lack of licensure backgrounding on these guys is because, you know, people who are unscrupulous tend to have patterns to what they do. And so in Ohio, when he was in deep trouble or, you know, under suspicion for overdosing a patient using fentanyl patches, a very powerful opiate, one of the most powerful drugs there is, essentially, you know, he repeated this pattern later, according to doctors who worked at the hospital, giving excessive doses of all sorts of opioids. Fentanyl didn't come up, but it was clear that when an ombudsman installed by the federal government came in during the bankruptcy, he put a sign on the door saying, "We are no longer going to prescribe narcotics at these levels. These are outrageous." And we didn't go into a great depth on that problem, but there were so many problems and so many financial shenanigans that, you know, just really trying to wrap our heads around this anything goes culture was a real challenge.
What kind of doctor is he?
He's an osteopath.
And what, explain that specialization for us.
Well, it's, you know, it's different than medical because you have a, essentially, it's just a field a little separate from actual Medicare because you have a different, totally different training. Doesn't, you know, make you a medical doctor, but you have, you know, just a different set of training.
So there are probably not a lot of hospitals in the country run by osteopaths that aren't osteopathic facilities. Is that correct?
You know, it's so difficult to track ownership, which is one of the problems we highlighted that I couldn't really tell you.
Why is it so hard to know who owns a hospital?
They're really good at hiding their identities. They can hide them behind corporate shells, limited liability partnerships. They can own a small percentage of a corporation that owns another corporation, yet they actually control it. It's, you know, it's really difficult to penetrate the veil, the corporate veil, And the federal government does not track owners of hospitals, at least effectively that we know. We tried to obtain a federal database called PACUS. It's a really drowsy sounding name. I doubt anybody's ever heard of it. But back in 2001, it was billed as a way to flag problem business histories for prospective hospital operators. And as far as we can tell, it's a real mess. And there have been numerous federal audits that have determined that, you know, addresses aren't even entered right. It's just a real mess, and we actually haven't been able to obtain it. That's one of the reasons it took us so long to do the project over a couple of years, because we're waiting for a lot of FOIAs that were never satisfied, a lot of Freedom of Information requests that were not granted.
We're speaking this hour with investigative reporter Miles Moffitt of the Dallas Morning News. You can find a link to his series, Blood Dry, Hospitals Fall Victim to Felons and Fraudsters Under Lax Regulation, at think.kera.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. Find us on Twitter @KERAThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dallas Morning News investigative reporter Miles Moffitt. You can find a link to his two-part series, the first part of which is called Bled Dry, Hospitals Fall Victim to Felons and Fraudsters Under Lax Regulation, at think.kera.org. If you would like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Miles, this was still nominally a nonprofit, although it sounds like Dr. Scocho was profiting handsomely. There had to be a board of directors. What access did they have to information about the management of this community resource?
Not much from what they say. And there were numerous people who were on the board, you know, between 1999 and 2010, even further, long after he took over. But they gave him, you know, control of that hospital lock, stock, and barrel. And I think, you know, being a doctor, they, you know, there's an additional level of trust that they gave him. And so in this small town, I need to make it clear that the reason this hospital was so critical is it's the only safe haven in the middle of Nevada between Reno and Vegas, the state's two gambling meccas. And, you know, more than 2 million cars pass through that town annually. And if there's an accident, if there's, you know, any myriad problems like, you know, high altitude sickness, no longer do people have a place to stop. But they did for, you know, almost 40 years. And so it was a crucial, you know, hospital for the state, for people all over the state, not just a small town. And so he enjoyed the kind of status most people don't have, right? So he not only ran the hospital, but he was the town's main doctor for, you know, this 3,000 to 4,000 population area, including for the city council members, the board members, just about everybody in town. He didn't want to drive, you know, 2 to 3 hours to get to another hospital. So one federal official noted that he believed that there was sort of a Stockholm syndrome that set in. People, you know, needed him, right? They needed their employer. They needed their doctor. Creates blind spots. You become almost emotionally, you know, too connected to this person. And he sort of enjoyed this this blind trust from a lot of people.
Where did revenue for the hospital come from? How was this hospital that had, you know, an immediate patient base of just a few thousand people able to generate so much money that he took away $8 million over the course
right.
of those years?
Well, unlike a lot of rural communities, there was a large population of privately insured patients, so, you know, workers at the Round Mountain gold mine within an hour away. That mine depended heavily on that hospital. You also have, you know, government employees. It's a county seat for Nye County. And so you have, you know, a lot of people who were on insurance. Perhaps 30, I think it was 60% of the population was privately insured, at least for a number of years. So, yeah, a lot of money came from private insurance, but also from Medicare and Medicaid. And these two programs are highly susceptible to abuse and fraud. And it's estimated that between 10 and 20% of Medicare funds annually are, you know, raked in through fraudulent means.
But Medicare and Medicaid, when they inspect for things, they're set up to deal with evident cases of fraud, but if there are other things going on, other problems, they can't levy fines.
So Medicare is principally the largest funder of America's hospitals, and roughly $200 billion a year. And so, yeah, it's our tax money that's essentially paying Medicare not only to care for people but to inspect these facilities. And yet the inspections only occur, you know, the standard inspection, not a complaint-based inspection, occur only, you know, every five to six years. So you really need a robust system of a community that is watching, and residents who are sophisticated enough to know when something, you know, looks wrong, to report it, or else they're not going to get inspected. And this is, you know, one of the weaknesses we've identified over the years. It's just, you know, really difficult to monitor what's happening inside a hospital. Now, Medicare safety regulations are tied in with financial regulations in a way to flag, you know, somebody who's inappropriately running their business financially. For instance, budgets are required. Now, in this case, nobody could find any budgets. It was as if Scotia and his wife were using it as an ATM machine, you know, just not really plotting a course for the hospital itself. They weren't putting money into the hospital, according to administrators. And so you've got this sort of death spiral with the money being pulled out, not any money invested in materials, anti-venom, IVs, you know, just very basic medical equipment and supplies and, you know, salaries, that sort of thing.
As the money started to run out, Scotia started firing people. At one point, he fired custodians, and it was the nurses providing patient care, also mopping the floors and, I guess, cleaning the toilets and whatever else needed to be done.
Yeah, you know, what was extraordinary is the amount of dedication that these nurses had. I mean, in talking with at least a dozen of them, these were professionals who just cared so deeply about, you know, people getting their treatment. And they wanted to keep the hospital open. And so, yeah, there was a period in 2009 where, you know, he was slashing money for staff. And yet there's this, you know, skeleton crew of nurses working, oh, my God, just these crazy 48-hour shifts for weeks on end. And, yes, taking up mops to just make sure the place was clean. And, of course, you know, there were reports that he wasn't showing up in the ER, which is a problem. And yeah, I mean, a lot of the money that he was taking was going to pay for a ranch, this sprawling ranch in the hill country of Texas outside of Kerrville. So he spent a lot of time there.
And he was using hospital credit cards for what had to have been personal travel and expenses? Mm.
Yes, definitely. So there were, yeah, I was able to obtain the thousands of receipts and able to determine that he was, you know, essentially being flown back to his ranch a couple of times a month. It's really difficult to discern how much time he was spending at that hospital. He was spending so much time at the ranch, and that included his CFO wife spending a lot of time there.
I know that you tried mightily to interview for him for this investigation, and he never wanted to talk to you. It has to be frustrating to begin to understand what someone is up to because you're looking at all the details of expenditures, and we'll talk in a minute about a memo that he put out, and not be able to just ask what was going through his head.
Absolutely. Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, if I can't interview the subject of my story, that's a certain failure. I mean, I want to know what he has to say about all of these allegations, and I tried very hard. I spent some time in Kerrville, you know, going back and forth between his house and his office. I interviewed his parents. I interviewed his ex-wife, one of his ex-wives.
Including the CEO, CFO ex-wife, right?
Yes, yes. And, well, it was a very short interview. you know, her name is all over a lot of this paperwork that demonstrated she profited, too. But, yeah, I mean, that, to me, was the most intriguing unanswered question. You know, why? And I could never get that answered from him personally.
Tell us about this memo that he put out that, frankly, reads not only like a document codifying micromanagement, but almost like a manifesto.
Right. So, yeah, this was a document. He had he had fired a slate of board members. I say fired. He had no legal justification to fire under the administrative rules of the hospital to fire his board members. But he went ahead and did it when they started asking questions about, you know, these companies, his personal companies that a lot of the hospital's money was flowing to. And his immediate posture was to shut down, you know, those inquiries and fire one by one, you know, or say, you know, you have now resigned, you know, typed up resignation letters and handed them to these board members. And again, you know, some of these board members were his patients and he controlled the hospital. So they did what he said. So, yeah, he was moving to oust another set of board members, and he started distributing a loyalty pledge. And this memo had these edicts, and it was called the Edicts of Ash Wednesday. I don't even know that it was actually delivered on Ash Wednesday, but just this list of commandments, you know, nobody will get a raise, no meetings unless I am present. And then they sort of swerved into this strange vernacular, Wall Street vernacular, like, you know, we eat what we kill. Phrases
that's a strange thing to say in a hospital.
Very strange thing, and made people deeply uncomfortable, of course. And yeah, and he asked them to pledge obedience to the omerta, which is a term for a code of silence used by the mafia and other organized crime groups. So, you know, there was plenty to be astonished and scared about in this memo. And I think, you know, that's part of his approach to management was, yeah, creating an atmosphere of fear. And sometimes he would walk into the hospital wearing only black and like black scrubs, and employees would, you know, get the message that something bad was going to happen. A lot of very strange antics.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go to the phones now in our conversation with Dallas Morning News investigative reporter Miles Moffitt. We will go first to Seth in Justin. Hi, Seth.
Hi. I was actually just listening there, and I wanted to know if there was a public repository where, you know, people like, you know, that are just listening could, you know, maybe research new hospitals that are operating in the area. Like, is there any way we could look into that?
And continue, Seth. What was the second part of your question?
And the second part was, can we relate any of the shortcomings that you were mentioning in, you know, hospital inspections, and is there any way that those are tied to existing regulations like ACA or any other laws that have been recently done with health care?
Well, very good question, Seth. You know, it's sort of an invisible marketplace, hospital purchases. There's just not a lot of publicity surrounding these deals. And I think it would be obviously a great public service if the government were to, you know, just create sort of an online tracking device, online marketplace, so people could actually, you know, discover who's taking over their local hospital. But yeah, like I was saying before, the federal data on hospital ownership through Medicare is just so messy, and it's just very difficult. So I would suggest just keeping tabs. I mean, if you're interested on whether your hospital is going up for sale, just, you know, one smart thing to do would just to call the state health department and ask if there's been a license application submitted for that hospital. You can ask them various things about, you know, the background of your current operator. I don't know that you're going to get much, unfortunately, but it doesn't hurt to ask. They will give you an enforcement history, which is also on the website, and that it's rare when the state health department actually sanctions a hospital, but there is a list and it's fairly well updated. Problem is you can't go too far back. So it's, yeah, there is not a real, you know, real community place to go to on the web to find out a lot of information about your hospital. Now, in terms of the inspection histories, it's another interesting question because the CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which oversees hospitals, destroys inspection reports every 6 years. However, they've been posting lump inspection data on their website for the past couple of years. So if you go into the CMS website under the certification and survey section, in fact, if you Google those things, then you should be able to find most recent inspection reports for your hospital.
As far as you could tell, did Dr. Vincent Scoccia break any laws?
A lot of what he did appears to be inconsistent with some statutes. But, yeah, it's really not my job to say. I, you know, leave that to the authorities.
Well, let me ask you this. People may say this is a fascinating story, but it's all about a small town in Nevada. Mm-hmm. What got you interested as a reporter for the Dallas Morning News?
Well, for several years, I've been focusing on patient harm and fraud in healthcare. Parkland Memorial Hospital and UT Southwestern Medical Center were, of course, the subject of a lot of pieces that my colleagues, Reese Dunklin, Sue Ambrose, Brooke Edgerton, and I have, written over many years, of course, in sort of digging into the problems with those two facilities. I became even more interested in hospitals and was checking like inspection reports for the Dallas area when I stumbled across this hospital in Terrell, which had been cited for just dozens and dozens of really serious patient harm violations over a span of 2 or 3 years. And it looked like it was on the verge of being shut down, and the government had threatened to terminate it. And I discovered that it was owned by a man named Dr. Tariq Mahmood, a Dallas businessman who lives in this Beverly Hills-style estate in Cedar Hill and also dabbles in other businesses like hotelery and own the Lawrence Hotel here in downtown Dallas. But yeah, I started discovering that he owned a chain of hospitals, all of which were very slum-like with their conditions.
All right, let me stop you there. We'll take a break. My guest is Dallas Morning News investigative reporter Miles Moffitt. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dallas Morning News investigative reporter Miles Moffitt. You can find a link to his series, the first part of which is Bled Dry, on the Think page, think.kera.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You mentioned earlier in the hour, Miles, that the doctor that you were investigating for this hospital in Nevada was a doctor of osteopathy, and we have, by the way, had a number of people write in and call in to tell us what that means. And Michael wrote, DOs are doctors of osteopathy. They are fully licensed doctors who can specialize in anything from pediatrics to neurosurgery. So we appreciate that update. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also find us on Twitter at KERA Think. You were telling us just before the break about this Dr. Tariq Mahmood, who you said lives in Cedar Hill and operates a facility in, where was it?
Terrell. But also in five other rural communities across Texas. They no longer exist. back in 2014, regulators were citing him with a lot of violations. And the more I delved into the paperwork, I discovered that patients had actually died due to negligent care at that hospital. In fact, three within the previous year leading up to this sort of warning by the feds that they were going to pull their funding. And so, yeah, I was curious that whether he owned other hospitals. And when I went to the Secretary of State database and just started, you know, plugging in his name, I found that he owned these other hospitals. I also found that the, you know, regulators didn't know he owned these other hospitals. So that gives you an idea of, you know, they're not aware of, you know, unscrupulous owners who own multiple facilities, primarily because they don't have the tools given to them by the state legislature, despite asking for them. But anyway, we found slum-like conditions. We found other questionable patient deaths. And so after we reported that, Governor Perry ordered a crackdown, and by the end of 2014, most of his hospitals had sold, collapsed in some way or another. And we started asking ourselves, are there other Dr. Mahmouds across the country and state? And, you know, how are they slipping into the system?
Who is Daniel De La Garza?
Convicted of crime tied to money laundering, convicted of illegal structuring of financial transactions, spent some time in a Colombian jail for allegedly trying to transport 2 kilos of cocaine into the United States back in the 80s, long history of crimes, and working as an informant with various criminal agencies. And yeah, he was able to, as soon as he got out of prison, he was able to take over several hospitals in the Dallas and Houston areas. And yeah, within years, most of them went into bankruptcy. But the question that arises is how, you know, how does somebody who appears to be a career criminal get in the system to run a hospital? And we can determine that because, one, the feds don't have any paperwork from the time. I don't know whether they threw it away or whether they never got any paperwork, but could find no paperwork demonstrating that he was ever a part of this hospital company that he oversaw. And once again, you know, just demonstrates that almost anybody can take over a hospital if you have a little money or a line of credit.
I'll confess that until I read this, it didn't occur to me that a person could own a hospital, a for-profit hospital, or sort of take over so completely a not-for-profit hospital.
Mm-hmm. So there's very few obstacles in your way. I mean, you and I could start up our own or take over a hospital this week if we wanted to and we had the backing. We could obtain a license. We could obtain certification.
So we don't need special background, special training. Nobody has to check into our past.
Well, they have very limited review of your background. There's what's called an exclusion database. So if you've been prosecuted for a health care related fraud offense, there's a very limited universe of things. If you're in that database, they will run your name against it, but that's really about it. And hospitals, unlike a lot of other healthcare businesses, are not required, their owners are not required to have a criminal background check. So, yeah, it's pretty, the door is wide open. And, you know, I've spoken with, you know, criminal agents, you know, with OIG and the FBI, who say, you know, it's simply mind-boggling because we've got guys fitting the profile of fraudsters and actual criminals walking through the door, but we're not doing anything to prevent them from doing that. We surveyed all 50 states to find out if any state in particular had strong vetting requirements. We had approximately 45 respond. About 35 states had nothing, just virtually nothing. Now, there are a few states that had standards for, you know, CEOs and chief administrators, like Pennsylvania requires a certain level of education and experience. Wisconsin asked about bankruptcies. So there's just this real patchwork of standards. But for the most part, anywhere in the country, you're not going to meet with any real scrutiny.
And 11 hospitals in Texas have gone belly up since 2010.
I'm not certain about that number, that exact number, but that sounds right. Yeah, I think there have been more than that, actually.
What I mean, obviously the people who worked there are out of a job and have to look for additional work. What happens to small communities that don't have, you know, five other hospitals, you know, within an easy drive?
Right. It can be devastating. You know, they're, first of all, hospitals also are big economic engines for communities. They're big employers. Most of the hospitals that we looked at were under 200 beds, but even at 200 beds, that's a pretty sizable facility, and you're often going to have hundreds of employees who work there. So, and then think about the collateral damage. So vendors in the community, like the bed suppliers, the tube suppliers, you know, they're going to be hurt if a hospital goes under. So, you know, there can be quite an economic effect. And then, of course, the most disturbing consequence is you're left without any immediate ER to go to. And like in Shelby County in East Texas, once Mahmoud shuttered that hospital under pressure from regulators, you know, 18-month-old girl who used to live down the street from the hospital choked on a grape. And this is a pretty easy sweeping maneuver for anybody who knows first aid, but her parents take her to the hospital and the doors were locked and she died. So, yeah, that gives you one example. And, of course, Lainey Ramirez, you know, trying to get her brother care in Tonopah, Nevada, drives 3 hours only to find out that he died because he couldn't get immediate oxygen.
It took too long to get into the hospital.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's got to be an effect on the community in that people who might have considered moving there don't want to live there.
Yeah. I mean, who wants to live in a community that doesn't have a hospital?
Having done all of this research, what kinds of changes should states look at, should communities look at, so that there are statutes to protect all of us as consumers from abuses like this?
Well, for one, just better vetting, just actual vetting. Pick up the phone if you're a health regulator and, you know, make some calls to check on the background of a prospective licensee. Of course, they need laws to, you know, enable them to do that. So, yeah, legislatures, Congress. You know, create actual background standards for prospective hospital operators. And at the local level, you know, there are hospital associations in Texas. TORCH is the association that represents rural hospitals. They're available to help communities in negotiations with prospective buyers. So, you know, tapping that kind of expertise might prevent somebody with a really wacky background from, you know, taking over their hospital and destroying it.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is investigative reporter Miles Moffitt of the Dallas Morning News. You can find a link to his series on hospitals falling victim to felons and fraudsters and others under lax regulation at think.kera.org. Is it possible for patients to know, should we, before visiting a hospital, investigate it? Is that the kind of thing we need to do now?
You know, it's one of those sort of, I mean, when it comes to being a health consumer and a patient, we're just up against so much these days. I mean, the Affordable Care Act was, you know, designed to empower patients in a lot of ways and to educate them. There was actually a component of the law that said that doctor-owned hospitals should place on their websites their identities, you know, divulge who the owners are. I haven't seen a lot of that happening. And that's just kind of a fundamental step. But patients, I think, you know, I mean, if they want to ensure that they get good care, it makes sense to do as much research as you can. Go onto public databases like, you know, Dallas County, for instance, has lawsuits online. You know, just run the hospital's name through, you know, that database. See what comes up. See if there are a lot of malpractice suits. Go to the Texas Medical Board's website. And, you know, if you know the names of doctors who work at that hospital, check their backgrounds. And yeah, you know, check the CMS web inspection data online. The Association of Healthcare Journalists, which is a national conglomerate of journalists, has a website where it essentially has the same inspection data, but it goes back further. And you can just click on your state and click on your community, and it'll show you the hospital, show you inspection reports you can click on. I think it's vital that people do as much as they can to background their own hospital and try to understand who's pulling the strings.
So Vincent Scotia took that hospital in Nevada into bankruptcy protection in 2013. Mm-hmm. It is closed now and no longer operating. What is his life like today?
So he's living with his parents in Kerrville. There was a settlement struck. The county, once they built a case that he had grossly mismanaged the hospital, they were like, you know, we need that money back. We need some of that money back. So they reached a settlement with him to turn back like $500,000. And I think the reason they didn't go after more was they were so focused on just keeping that hospital running, you know, and didn't want a lot of legal entanglements. But you know, he's supposed to be paying that back. I've heard he is making payments. He set up a clinic called the Kerrville Comprehensive Clinic. It's a little storefront and just a little office complex outside the hospital there. And when I arrived one day, it was pretty dark, but his dad was behind the counter, and I was, of course, still looking for him, and I just sat in the lobby to see if he would walk in the door. And some patients came in and asked his dad questions about whether they could get certain records because they had surgeries coming up. And his dad was like, I don't know where my son is. You're basically out of luck. And so they left the office. You know, that's kind of the story with Scotia. It's like, you know, catch me if you can. And I don't really know what it, I know he's traveling. He's got licenses to practice medicine in Montana, Ohio. I know he was doing some work at a military base here in Texas. So he's on the go.
Where's all that money?
Well, so the big ranch that he purchased with a lot of that money, if you go to Kerrville, there's one of the highest hills outside of town. You go up this winding road, and you see what looks like the Alamo. And it's a giant facade that was designed to replicate the monument almost down to the white stone. He spent $700,000 to $800,000 on that gated entryway alone, from what I understand. And
we'll have to leave it there because we're out of time. But people can read the piece, Bled Dry, at think.kera.org. There's a link to that Dallas Morning News story by Miles Moffitt. Miles, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
Appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast at think.kera.org. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.